one of the critiques that I find to be fair is the smorgasbord approach to the ancient, and I think in some ways we contribute to this. Maybe it's a problem here in that we say, well, let's just pick and choose, and we never root ourselves anywhere. We never build any kind of sense of tradition. And I think that's a fair critique of much of what's happening in emerging ministry is it's a novelty-oriented, try this, and then we're bored of that, and try this, and
yes.
And so how do we, that's one of the questions that I have, is how do we root ourselves in a tradition and hang on to it and say, wonderful what you're doing, you know, but we're just going to stick it out here as something that is not modern.
Yeah. It's a really good question. I'll just tell you something humorous. I was given a CD once of some people doing some critique of my work. One of the people said, McLaren is like a little boy who walks into a candy shop and he's too cheap to spend his quarter. So he walks through the store licking every lollipop. That was his way of saying this danger. And the fact is, I see this all over the place. It really is a problem. Let me give you a counterpoint example and then come back to it. I don't know if any of you have ever read Ziauddin Sardar. He's an absolutely brilliant Muslim philosopher. If you ever want to read some things that will make you see the world in a new way and help you understand Islam, the last name is Sardar, and the first name is Ziauddin, I think. But if you just remember Sardar, Sardar, and there he has a book called Islam, Postmodernism, and Other Futures. If you want to read one essay, he has an essay there on the Walt Disney film Pocahontas. And he uses the Walt Disney film Pocahontas to show how colonialism works. And it's devastating. It is just devastating. But Sardar has another article, not in that book. It's in a book called Consuming Kuala Lumpur. Actually, he has two essays in each of these books dealing with this. But there are there are Arabic forms of music that go back, you know, a long way. And for people who are either Arabic or they're Muslim, who then have an affinity to Arabic history and culture, apparently some of these forms of singing are just very, very moving. And to our Western ears, they tend to sound strange, but that's how things go in cultures. And what happened is this one singer has popularized so much of this ancient Arabic music. And Sardar speaks glowingly about how it brings tears to his eyes and touches him at the deepest parts of his soul. But then Sardar goes ballistic, because then this guy started taking these ancient Arabic forms and putting them over drum loops. And now they're becoming really popular in Europe as a way of sort of making this stuff come alive. And he sees this as the bastardization of this. And this is what Western culture does. It consumes everything and turns it into a product and destroys it, you know. So I use that example just to say that a lot of people from the West feel the same way about when things are taken from our own culture as Sardar feels about this happening from his culture. And I'm certainly sympathetic. I don't think it's either or. The fact is, for Christians, just to be fair, the fact that if your church uses a piano, you've already adopted new technology for singing, you know. If you use an organ, an organ, that's bad enough. Piano's even worse. You know what I'm saying? There's a certain sense, the things that we consider tradition were technical innovations at some point. Now, theologically, though, your point has an awful lot to say, and I'm sure it's a critique that people would have of IWS. Let me use an example. I won't use a name, but I'll use an example. Many of you have read my book, Generous Orthodoxy, and I speak very affirmingly of Eastern Orthodox soteriology. And I heard Daryl use the term perichoresis, which has been a treasure of the Eastern Church. And, you know, I might think that Eastern Orthodox folks would start saying, wow, isn't that great? Protestants are starting to discover some of our treasures. And, you know, but what I often hear from my Eastern Orthodox friends is exactly this. You can't have a piece of it without taking the whole package. And you are bastardizing our tradition, to use any of our language, without submitting to our ecclesiology. And I understand why they're saying that, but at that point, what can I do? I'm not converting, you know? But you can't keep me from discovering truth in your great literature, you know? And this is part of what's happening in this world, you know? And in a certain way, this becomes something every Protestant group is going to face. When you consider any truth your proprietary information, you can't have this truth unless you're with us. This seems to be part of what the gospel undermines. It seems to be what's happening in the book of Acts in chapter 10 when Peter discovers that the truth is getting discovered by outsiders and he's got to make the decision, do you force them to become insiders? Maybe I could throw one other comment about this and then I'll come back and reaffirm your question. I jokingly, not really jokingly, semi-humorously say, we're at the 100th anniversary of Pentecostalism, and what I hope for in the next century is Pentecostalism chapter 2. Chapter 1 of Pentecostalism is discovering what the Holy Spirit can do in church buildings or church meetings at the end of long services with hot preaching and emotional music. Pentecostalism chapter 2 would be to discover what the Holy Spirit can do outside the church, in relation to politics and in relation to culture, in relation to some of these other things. Because it strikes me, especially in the Gospel of John, that when Jesus describes the realm of the work of the Spirit, he doesn't describe it in relation to the church. Remember, he says, it's better for you that I go away, because if I go away, I'll send the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, the Comforter, and he will convict the world of sin, righteousness, and judgment to come. So the sphere of activity of the Holy Spirit becomes the world. And I think part of what we've got to do is recognize that the Holy Spirit doesn't respect our boundaries. Now, some of my friends would get upset with me for saying that, but it certainly seems to be true in the book of Acts. It's true in the Gospels, you know. I mean, isn't that interchange between Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman an interesting example, you know? It's almost as if in that encounter, Jesus himself, whose calling has been to the lost sheep of Israel, which, by the way, properly understood, is not Jesus saying, I'm a Jew and the gospel is for us and not for you filthy Gentiles. He's saying, I think, something more like this. Look, lady, the people of Israel are lost sheep. They're in deep weeds and I've got enough work to do helping them. You know, I was sent to help them. And then she says, well, how about some crumbs from the table, you know? There's no way you can make the line about dogs palatable. You know, I've heard preachers say, oh, the Greek word means puppies, you know? I mean, that doesn't help. But what becomes so interesting is in that interchange, I see something happening, interestingly, with a woman, parallel to what happens in John 2 at the wedding of Cana, when Jesus says to his mother, woman, why are you bothering me? And she goes behind his back and says to the people, whatever he tells you to do, do it. And he does it, you know. So what I hear happening is when his mother comes to him and says, basically, do a miracle, he says, woman, my time has not yet come. But at that moment, his time came. And I see something happening with the Syrophoenician woman, too. I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel, but when he sees her faith, I think he must hear the voice of the Father saying, I'm out of the box here, you know, and I think this is part of our huge challenge. What if, because it seems to me we only have two alternatives. We maintain our sectarianism, or the whole thing dies, or else we start sharing treasures across our sects, and out of that drawing deeply, something new emerges. The danger in that is dilettantism, licking lollipops, as this guy said. That's truly a danger. But here's my problem with my, if I can speak very frankly, my friends who say, you can't have our stuff unless you're one of us. What they're doing is they're turning their tradition into a dead tradition. A living tradition keeps in touch with its roots, but it keeps growing new leaves and new branches. But a dead tradition doesn't allow itself into new territory. You can cut off and lose tradition, but it seems to me a living tradition always is expanding. And one of the ways traditions expand is by their encounter with the other. And this, to me, is what it's something like IWS does. It creates space for encounter with the other so the sharing of treasures can take place and keep all the traditions living.
I think that's a wonderful picture. You know, think of the tree. I guess what seems a valid concern is people who only want to live in the leaves.
Yes, yes.
And you know, I'm part of a church that's Methodist in history.
Yes.
But no one knows about that history.
Yes.
Because we're all grabbing the leaves all the time. And so we have to learn Wesley hymns.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe we do it with a guitar or something.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the really part of the issue here is how do you not live in the leaves and not live only in the ruins?
Can I make it a little... Yeah, exactly right. And I'll make it a little more complex. How do we reinterpret Wesley? How do we take Wesley's genius and apply it today? Let me use an example from our Reformed brothers and sisters and then an example from Wesley. And then we will move on and we'll get to some other questions later. But most people don't know that John Calvin wrote the first edition of the Institutes of the Christian Religion, began writing it at the age of 19, and finished the first edition before he was 25, or before he was 26. So he wrote Institutes of the Christian Religion from 19 to 25. Now, he continued to edit it through his life, but the first edition was written in that age. And of course, if John Calvin were alive today, nobody would listen to him as a 25-year-old. So the tradition creates the conditions that make it impossible for it to ever experience rebirth or renewal. See? Now, then the question that each tradition has to say is this. Calvin was, I think what Calvin's instinct was, and many of my Reformed friends would just despise this moment for me even taking that holy name upon my lips. But as you know, there are very, very different ways of interpreting Calvin. And the word reform means an awful lot of things. And if you're reformed, can I just warn you that your tradition is trying to lop off a whole lot of branches on the tree and only keep, you know, they're trying to do some major trunk pruning here, you know. But one way to understand Calvin is to say Calvin realizes that Catholicism has lost its hegemony and that something new is happening, but that there's a huge vacuum created, that Luther has created a vacuum, and that when you lose some of the resources of Catholicism, you better fill in the vacuum or you're going to have chaos. So at the age of 19, he sees this and he creates a system to fill in the vacuum. Now, to be faithful to Calvin, do we have to say for the rest of history exactly what Calvin said? Or are we being faithful to Calvin to look at our world at the age of 19 and say, what's the desperate need today? And how can we boldly step in to try to meet it? In a way, to follow Calvin's example, you may say different things than Calvin said. Because new questions are being raised. And maybe the issue today is that European colonial Christianity is in today a very similar situation to Southern, say it this way, Northern European colonial Christianity is in a very similar position to Southern European Catholic Christianity at the time of Calvin. What if that's true? Then we need a new Calvin. in certain ways. And Wesley is another interesting example, because I think Calvin saw the vacuum for theological framework. I think nobody saw the vacuum for spiritual formation. And I think the vacuum just sat there in Northern Europe. The Lutheran Pietists tried to fill it. There were several movements that tried to fill it. But Catholicism for 1,300 years had developed an elaborate process of spiritual formation. I mean, by the time you get to the 16th century, 17th century, Catholicism had an amazingly well-developed system of spiritual formation. Just truly amazing, especially for largely illiterate people. You know, I have quarrels with a lot of things, but I have quarrels with myself. So, but I'm in awe of the form of spiritual formation. Then, with the Protestant Reformation, most of it gets thrown away. And I don't think it's until Wesley that a new method of spiritual formation is really made available to the masses, you know. And so now we're at a point where, what do we do in a world that's post-industrial? Because part of the brilliance of Wesley is he created a form of spirituality that could be used by working-class people in the rise of industrialism. What do we do in a post-industrial, information-based economy? We need a new Wesley. And that's not being unfaithful to Wesley or an insult to Wesley. In my mind, it's saying the Wesleyan impulse has to be rediscovered. And there's so much wisdom. And that's why... Isn't that why a lot of you signed up for this school? Because you thought, you know, my theological training, if I had, you know, formal theological training, never really had me talking about worship and spiritual formation. I really need to learn about that. Anyway, that's a good segue, because I want us to talk about spiritual formation.